From Washington, this is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, Crimeans vote on joining Russia. UN says Nigeria's Boko Haram insurgency is increasingly monstrous. The latest on the missing Malaysian passenger plane, plus Mideast peace, that is, high on today's agenda at the White House. Hello, everyone. I'm Steve Norman. In a Sunday phone conversation, President Obama told Russian President Vladimir Putin Washington and its European partners are prepared to impose additional cost on Moscow for backing a secession referendum in Ukraine's Crimean Peninsula. News of the phone call came as Crimean election authorities said 95% of voters on Sunday cast ballots supporting secession and a move to join Russia. And in Kiev, Ukraine's interim prime minister, Arseniy Yatsenyuk, speaking at an emergency cabinet meeting, called the Moscow-backed Crimea vote a circus spectacle directed at gunpoint by Russia. Now we go to the Crimean capital, Simferopol, where VOA's Elizabeth Arrett reports many Crimeans on Sunday said they were happy to cast their votes in favor of Moscow.
Crimeans took part in the controversial referendum Sunday, but there were few surprises in a vote many say was decided 2 weeks ago, when Russian and pro-Russian forces took control. Opponents say it was a sham, but for many, particularly the elderly at polling stations in the regional capital, Simferopol, the idea of coming back under Moscow's rule, as the region was in Soviet days, is a dream come true.
It's been 23 years. Don't make me cry.
Crimean Parliament member Vladimir Klitschnikov agreed.
People have an opportunity to determine their future and the future of their children. It's a celebration of democracy.
And indeed, a fair amount of money was spent in the run-up to the vote to present this as a festive pro-Russian occasion. Entertainers from already Russian republics took to the stage in central Simferopol to cheer on voters to the polls, including dancers from Russia's Tatarstan, a nod to Crimea's Tatar community, whose leaders vowed to boycott the referendum as illegal. In Bakhchisarai, a traditional Tatar town, officials at one polling station say overall turnout was good, but added only about a quarter of the Tatars on the list had taken part.
We had heard that Crimean Tatars would sabotage voting because they had received tacit orders. But you can see that everything is going calmly and nobody is causing problems.
Despite deep opposition from some Tatars and ethnic Ukrainians, there were few reports of problems at the polls. But the opposition is there. Crimean Tatar Ervin Rustemovich rejects the idea of coming under Russian rule.
People don't understand that they won't keep their promises. Any sensible person understands that. Nothing is given for free. Nobody cares about us there.
Many people do care what's happening to Crimeans, but for those who wanted it to stay clearly part of Ukraine, there didn't appear much they could do. Elizabeth Arrett, VOA News, Simferopol.
The Malaysian government has appealed for international coordination in the search for a missing Malaysia Airlines passenger jet that stretches from the Caspian Sea to the southern Indian Ocean. Malaysian officials say the number of countries involved in the search has grown from 14 to 25. Hisham Mudin Hussein is Malaysia's acting transport minister.
Malaysian officials are requesting support from these countries as well as others. This support includes general satellite data, radar playback, both primary and secondary, provisions for ground, sea, and aerial search, and assets as appropriate.
Meantime, police are examining a flight simulator belonging to one of the pilots of the Malaysia Airlines plane, which went missing more than a week ago with 239 passengers aboard from Kuala Lumpur to Beijing. Khalid Abu Bakr is Malaysia's Inspector General of Police.
We took possession of a simulator, of a flight simulator, and we have dismantled it from the home, and we have assembled it at our office, and we are getting experts to look at it now.
The search for Flight 370 has expanded after satellite data has shown that after losing contact with air traffic controllers, the plane could have kept flying for several hours.
News is mobile, and so are you. Get VOA on the go. Get VOA on Google Currents. Get VOA News specifically made for your tablet and smartphone. Clean, simple, fast. Now available for Android or Apple phones or tablets. Download the Google Currents app for free today. Get VOA on Google Currents at voanews.com/currents.
Troubled Israeli-Palestinian peace talks take center stage later today at the White House. Robert Berger reports for VOA from Jerusalem.
Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas will meet President Barack Obama with a deadline looming at the end of April for a framework peace agreement. The proposed framework would cover the thorniest issues of the conflict: the status of Jerusalem, Palestinian refugees, Jewish settlements, security, and the final borders of a Palestinian state. The United States is pressing both sides to compromise, but expectations are low and gaps are wide. Palestinian spokesman Ahmed Assaf says his side will accept nothing less than a Palestinian state on the 1967 borders with East Jerusalem as its capital. Israel says the 67 lines are indefensible, and it has vowed not to compromise on Jerusalem, saying the entire city is its eternal capital. Another stumbling block is Israel's demand to be recognized as a Jewish state. Mr. Abbas has refused, saying that would harm the rights of Israeli Arabs, as well as the right of return of Palestinian refugees to their former homes in Israel. So after more than 7 months of U.S.-mediated peace talks, there is growing pessimism and acrimony. Israeli Defense Minister Moshe Yaalon said the Palestinian president is not a partner for a final peace agreement that would end the conflict, adding that Mr. Abbas is a partner who wants to take but does not want to give. Robert Berger for VOA News, Jerusalem.
Recent times have seen street battles between Palestinians and Israeli police in Jerusalem, and Israeli bombardment of the Gaza Strip after militants fired more rockets at Israel. Today's meeting at the White House comes against that backdrop. We get more now from VOA's Luis Ramirez at the White House.
Last month, Secretary of State John Kerry and Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas met in Paris for intense diplomatic talks on the effort. Now it's Mr. Abbas's turn to come to the White House, where Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu 2 weeks ago heard President Obama express his hopes for a solution.
It's my belief that ultimately it is still possible to create two states, a Jewish state of Israel and a state of Palestine, in which people are living side by side in peace and security. But it's difficult, and it requires compromise on all sides.
President Abbas has said there is no way the Palestinians would accept recognizing Israel as a Jewish state, a key Israeli demand. White House spokesman Jay Carney says the president will press for difficult concessions.
He will discuss progress made with President Abbas, as he did with Prime Minister Netanyahu. He will commend President Abbas, as he did Prime Minister Netanyahu, on the tough decisions that each leader has made thus far in an effort to move the process forward.
President Abbas has shown signs of flexibility on a long-standing key issue: the Palestinians' insistence that they be given the right to return to areas they fled or were forced to leave when Israel was established in 1948.
Let's put the issue of refugees on the table, because it is an issue that must be resolved to put an end to the conflict, so that the refugees can be satisfied with the solution. But we do not seek and we will not work toward flooding Israel with millions of refugees, which would change its social composition.
Aaron David Miller was an advisor to U.S. Secretaries of State on Arab-Israeli negotiations for 25 years. He says Monday's meeting shows the White House sees an opportunity for progress, but he is not optimistic.
There were indications, at least in the run-up to the Netanyahu meeting, that the president was increasingly frustrated with the Israelis. This will be a better meeting, but I'm not sure how productive it's going to be.
Despite being preoccupied with events in Ukraine, President Obama sees this as a priority and wants to press on Mr. Abbas that time is running out as an April 29th deadline draws near for a framework agreement. Luis Ramirez, VOA News at the White House.
Syrian government forces appear to have recaptured large portions of the bitterly contested mountain town of Yabrud along the border with Lebanon. Opposition activists claim pockets of rebel forces are still holding out in portions of the town and the hills overlooking it. Edward Uranian has a report from the VOA Middle East Bureau.
A Syrian army spokesman called the capture of Yabrud a decisive blow against terrorism and will choke rebel supply lines to neighboring Lebanon. He says the Syrian army victory in Yabrud has brought stability and security to the mountains north of Damascus and killed a large number of mercenaries and terrorists. Syrian opposition leader Ahmed Jarba told Arab satellite channels the government victory in Yabrud was largely the work of Lebanon's Hezbollah militia and other Shiite militiamen. He says rebel forces are waging a bitter battle against an enemy with no scruples. Edward Uranian for VOA News, Cairo.
United Nations says nearly 500,000 people in northern Nigeria have fled their homes in fear of what is being called an increasingly monstrous insurgency that threatens food security in many parts of the country. Heather Murdoch is in Abuja with our report.
UN High Commissioner for Human Rights Navi Pillay says the insurgency in northeastern Nigeria has spilled across borders into neighboring West African countries, along with nearly 60,000 refugees.
With thousands of refugees fleeing from Nigeria and arms and fighters reportedly flowing across international borders in the other direction, this terrible conflict is no longer solely an internal matter.
She says Nigeria should broaden its counterterrorism strategy and work more closely with neighbors and the international community to stop the Islamist militant group known as Boko Haram. Inside Nigeria, she adds, farmers have abandoned their fields as they flee the insurgents, threatening food security in many areas. Boko Haram has been blamed for thousands of deaths since launching its uprising against the government in 2009. Human Rights Watch says 2014 so far may be the worst year of the insurgency. It says the group has killed 700 people in attacks on 40 villages this year, displacing hundreds of thousands of people. At least 25 women and girls have been kidnapped. Again, here's Navi Pillay.
They have burned down houses, churches, clinics, and schools. They have murdered children in their beds. Some of its members are reported to have abducted and raped women and girls.
Pillay also warns that heavy-handed tactics by security forces fighting Boko Haram can put civilians' lives at risk.
Many people I have met with during this visit openly acknowledged human rights violations have been committed by the security forces, and these have served to alienate local communities and created fertile ground for Boko Haram to cultivate new recruits.
Human Rights Watch says despite 10 months of emergency rule in the three most dangerous northeastern states, the crisis continues to expand. But it warns that when Nigeria or neighboring countries close borders to keep militants and weapons out, it only makes things worse, forcing families to stay in places where their lives are in danger. Human Rights Watch Nigeria researcher Mousi Segun.
Boko Haram is able to run around and kill so many people and cause so much destruction. I think it really has been a failure on the part of the government to protect the people, their lives and their properties.
The Nigerian military maintains that it is beating Boko Haram, and violence has increased recently because so many of their camps have been destroyed, leaving surviving fighters desperate. Heather Murdoch for VOA News, Abuja.
Nigerian officials are saying at least 16 people were killed in stampedes when 500,000 people were invited to apply for fewer than 5,000 government jobs. There is a high level of unemployment in Nigeria, especially among young people. In 2011, it stood at nearly 24%. The UN Refugee Agency reports that more and more refugees from the troubled Central African Republic are arriving in Cameroon in desperate condition, with many of them sick and dying. UNHCR spokesperson Fatoumata Lejeune Kaba says the new arrivals from the CAR tell aid workers they were forced to hide in the bush for long periods in fear of being killed by anti-Balaka militiamen who were targeting Muslims in revenge attacks. She says the refugees say they had no choice but to flee for their lives despite the hardships that they've encountered on the way to Cameroon.
Many have lost relatives to hunger along the way, or shortly after reaching Cameroon. They are also very much traumatized by the horrors they experienced in northwestern CAR. As an example, we have one refugee who said that he could no longer eat meat because he had seen someone being killed and cut into pieces by the anti-Balaka. A woman has lost six of her nine children in the bushes after 7 weeks. And this is a woman whose husband was also killed by the anti-Balaka.
Lejeune Kaba tells VOA it's not unusual to have refugees arriving in a country of asylum, exhausted, sick, and hungry. But she says the extremely dire condition of the CAR refugees upon arrival is not normal.
We do have cases in refugee situations where people travel long distances and come exhausted, for sure. We've seen it with the Sudanese who were fleeing from the Blue Nile, for example, coming into South Sudan. But we didn't systematically hear about losing family members along the way we are hearing from the CAR refugees now.
UNHCR reports that more than 44,000 refugees from the CAR have fled to Cameroon since March of last year. That is when Muslim Seleka forces seized the capital Bangui and ousted the government. International Rescue Committee says early rains in South Sudan have created catastrophic conditions for the thousands of displaced people there. Humanitarian agency says it's a race against time to provide shelter, sanitation, as well as clean water. VOA's Joe DiCapua reports.
Heavy rain and powerful winds struck Juba last Friday night. The storm lasted just an hour, but when the skies cleared, the damage was severe. IRC South Sudan Country Director Wendy Teuber surveyed the UN-topping displacement camp, once filled with shelters made of plastic sheeting and bamboo sticks.
646 were destroyed in just 1 hour of that intense rain with the severe wind. The base holds 23,000 people, but if 1 hour of rain can do that kind of damage, it's a matter of time before hundreds more are losing their shelters.
About 8,000 people are living in flood conditions at the Tomping site. The IRC and other groups are encouraging the displaced to move to sites on higher ground. But Teuber says many are reluctant to move.
There's two bases holding displaced people in Juba. One of them is lower than the other. So one idea to try and help the situation is to relocate them to the drier site, which is also flood-prone, but not as bad. But this is all within Juba. People are afraid to move too much, so it's a matter of making sure we can guarantee safety if we are able to move them to the other sites.
Teuber says at least 10,000 people should be moved from Tomping. The other UN base where the displaced have gathered in Juba is known as UN House. The muddy conditions will make any effort to move the displaced difficult. Teuber says another big storm is expected to hit the area in a few days. The roads around the camps are made of morum, a mixture of stone, sand, and earth. Teuber says when the roads collapsed from the rains, people used pieces of morum to construct shelters. In all, there are more than 700,000 internally displaced people in South Sudan. The early rains are expected to spread soon from the Juba area to other parts of South Sudan. Some 200 kilometers north of Juba, there's concern about what might happen in Minkaman, in Awerial County in East Lake State. There are about 50,000 displaced people there, many sheltering under trees. Construction has just begun on three new sites for the displaced in Minkaman. The International Rescue Committee country director says it's difficult to pre-position emergency supplies in South Sudan.
It's a difficult choice whether to have them stored here in a central location and then bring them out when the rain might make a place inaccessible, or send them out now. But in terms of the fighting that's still ongoing and lack of law and order in these areas, there's a great risk of losing the materials to looting and theft.
The International Rescue Committee also has programs in South Sudan to help protect women and girls from sexual violence. Teuber says as women leave the safety of camps to find shelter materials, they are vulnerable to attack. It's unclear how many women and girls may have been attacked since the conflict began in December. Teuber says South Sudanese women are hesitant to report such incidents. Joe DiCapua, VOA News, Washington.
For more on the stories you've heard on our radio programs, visit our website at voanews.com. That's where you'll find in-depth reports, related stories, videos, and more from our team of correspondents. Or take the news with you by downloading podcasts of your favorite VOA program. That's at voanews.com.
voanews.com.
Online news for a changing world.
Warmer climate at the poles has accelerated the loss of ice mass and raised concerns about sea level rise and other impacts on the weather. And as VOA's Roseanne Skirbel reports, a new study finds dramatic new thinning in the Greenland ice sheet in a region considered stable until now.
Last July, Kirk Kerr was collecting sample sediment cores from a lake bed in southeastern Greenland when his science team witnessed a dramatic event.
We landed and suddenly you could feel that the ground was starting to shake.
The research director of the Natural History Museum of Denmark at the University of Copenhagen is co-author of the new study about the Greenland ice sheet.
And, you know, we turned around, you know, and we could see, oh, there's a calving event. Two huge icebergs that are 700 meters deep that are coming out of the, that has been released from the glacier and that is turning around. And you know, you can actually pick up the signal, you know, from seismic station due to these shaking of the earth all the way down to Japan.
Ice sheets like those in Greenland and Antarctica are constantly in motion. Calving at the ocean's edge is part of that natural cycle as the ice mass flows downhill under its own weight, moving through ice streams, glaciers, and ice shelves. The sheet remains stable as long as it accumulates the same mass of snow that it loses at sea. For their study, published online in the journal Nature Climate Change, the scientists collected surface elevation from the entire ice sheet using satellite data. While they knew that the southeast and northwest were already losing mass at accelerated rates, Kerr says they hadn't expected to see sustained loss in northeastern Greenland, which was considered stable.
So it's a new area that has started to react to a warmer climate, and it's warming in the sense that it's a warmer summer temperatures and warmer ocean temperatures.
Reduced sea ice, where the glacier meets the warmer ocean, allows icebergs to break off from the edge of the shelf. That causes the ice stream to accelerate toward the sea. The northeastern ice stream drains almost 16% of Greenland. Kerr says their findings will affect the models of future sea level rise.
Of course, it's a concern. And there you can say that if you have an area in Greenland, like the northeastern sector, that has been considered stable, but not contributing to any significant sea level rise, it's somewhat of a bigger surprise, you could say.
He adds that scientists will look back at the history of the ice sheet to put more recent observation in perspective.
But my feeling is that we will see that the mass loss that we have seen over the last 10 years is something that is out of the ordinary.
Kerr says the new data will improve predictions of changes in a warmer world. Roseanne Skirbel, VOA News, Washington.
And here's an amazing statistic for you. Americans spent an all-time high of $55.7 billion on their pets last year, and those numbers are expected to be closer to $60 billion this year, and the American Pet Products Association says the biggest part of it in 2013 was the food at nearly $22 billion, an amazing amount of food for pets. I know I spent some of that. Many thanks, everyone, for joining us here for International Edition on the Voice of America. Good to have you with us. A reminder, you can always find us on the internet at voanews.com. Hope you'll stay with us. The latest world news is coming up shortly. For our director, Tracy Carter, and engineer, John Ellison, I'm Steve Norman in Washington. Have a great Monday.
This is Today in History. On March 17th, 45 BC, Julius Caesar defeated Republican forces in the Battle of Munda in modern-day Spain. The victory led to his dictatorial rule of the Roman Empire, but that didn't last long. Caesar was murdered the following year on March 15th. March 17th is celebrated as St. Patrick's Day, a national and religious holiday in the Irish Republic in honor of the country's patron saint. It is thought to be the date on which he died in or about 460 AD. In 1901, paintings by the Dutch master Vincent van Gogh were shown at a major Paris art gallery. The 71 paintings caused a sensation in the art world, bringing acclaim to the artist who had died a decade earlier. In 1905, on this date, future President Franklin Delano Roosevelt married his fifth cousin, once removed, Eleanor Roosevelt, in New York. In 1921, there was a revolt by Russian sailors in Kronstadt, a naval station on the Gulf of Finland that served as the base for the Russian Baltic Fleet. Thousands were killed in the unsuccessful uprising against the Bolsheviks. On March 17, 1941, the National Gallery of Art was dedicated in Washington, D.C. In 1959, the 14th Dalai Lama fled Tibet for India. He remained the leader of Tibetan exiles until his retirement on March 14, 2011. On this day in 1969, Golda Meir became the fourth Prime Minister of Israel. Born in Kiev, she grew up in the United States before immigrating in 1921 to Palestine, administered at that time by the British. I'm Dave DeForest with VOA's Today in History.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
An international tribunal has convicted a former Congolese militia leader of war crimes and crimes against humanity for his role in a deadly attack in 2003 by his troops on a village in the Eastern Democratic Republic of the Congo. The trial chamber of the International Criminal Court at The Hague found Germain Katanga, former leader of the Force de Résistance Patriotique, guilty of four counts of war crimes and one count of crimes against humanity for his role in the assault by rebel forces on the village of Bogoro in Ituri district in February 2003. Some 200 people were reportedly killed, and women were raped and used as sex slaves. In a 2-1 ruling, the court found that during the fighting that roiled the region for many years, Katanga made a significant contribution to the commission of crimes committed in the Bogoro attack through his role in arming the fighters and reinforcing the strike capability of the militia. The court's action against Katanga, also known by his warlord nickname Simba, or the Lion, is the third time the court has rendered a verdict in the Democratic Republic of the Congo situation. The ICC's DRC cases represent a significant step toward delivering justice for victims there. Past impunity for such atrocities has fueled a destabilizing cycle of conflict, and it is clear that those responsible for war crimes and crimes against humanity must be held to account. Another ICC-indicted leader of an abusive militia in the DRC, Silvestre Mutachimura, is still at large. The United States calls again for his arrest and continues to offer a reward of up to $5 million for information leading to his arrest, transfer, or conviction. In addition to the work of the ICC, strong and effective national courts also have a role to play in ending impunity in the DRC. We continue to support the Congolese government's efforts to hold perpetrators accountable through its domestic institutions, including the creation of mixed chambers. The DRC government is currently considering draft legislation to submit to the DRC Parliament.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. If you have a comment, please write to Editorials, VOA, Washington, D.C., 20237, USA. You may also comment and view all our current editorials at the VOA Editorials homepage, www.voanews.com/editorials.